Calling to order the House Election Finance and Government Operations Committee. And Representative Altendorf, have you looked at the minutes?
I have, and I move approval of the February 26th minutes.
Thank you. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Would the author of House File 484 please go to the testifier table? And I noticed that Mr. Wagner and Mr. Foster, if you also wanted to proceed to the two chairs next. And Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 484 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Housing Committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Would the author please state your name and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Shane Mecklen, this is a bill that I have either had it in a bill form or an amendment numerous times in the Energy Committee. I'm sure Representative Akam can testify to that. And basically what this is there's been a national push or movement to allow local municipalities to prohibit the installation of natural gas hookups or, again, this is natural gas. And that is, this would simply prohibit that. And as I've testified numerous times in Energy Committee a couple of years ago, maybe Representative Akin can refresh my memory, but I did buy an air source heat pump so that I have dual fuel and able to heat more than one way. But unfortunately, this year it failed and it still does not work. So it furthers the point of having more than one way, means to heat a home, especially when it's 20 below like we've had in the not too distant past, is the point of this bill, Mr. Chair. And I do have Mr. Foster who can testify, and we may have you just testify on the other because it's kind of your arena.
Thank you, Representative. And the first testifier is Mr. Foster. Please proceed, and identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Quam and committee members. My name is Mark Foster, and I am the Vice President of Legislative and Political Affairs for Housing First Minnesota. We're a trade group of nearly 1,000 members of the home building industry that have one goal in mind, advancing home ownership opportunities for all Minnesotans. And today's our day on the Hill. Some of our members might have meetings with you, hence the big button. I want to thank the opportunity to testify in support of Representative Mecklen's House File 484. As we work with your colleagues in other committees to legalize more housing options statewide through land use and zoning reform, we appreciate the language before you as a method of keeping affordable and reliable fuel source options for residential construction legal as well. As the committee is likely aware, residential new construction costs are at an all-time high, north of $540,000 for a new single-family home statewide, and we are over 100,000 units short of what would be considered a healthy housing market. So with all of this in mind, all policies that impact residential construction need to be viewed through the lens of how to improve affordability and how to remove roadblocks to the construction of more housing units. Recent data shows that natural gas is the most utilized fuel source of residential energy use, with data from the U.S. Energy Information Administration showing 65% of residential energy usage in Minnesota came from natural gas during 2022. Protecting it as a fuel source option for residential construction statewide for the immediate future is helpful for consumers, for cost savings, and for predictability of development. And for these reasons, we urge you to support the bill. Thank you again.
Thank you. And Mr. Wagner.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair Quam and members. My name is Dave Wager. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Propane Association. The Minnesota Propane Association supports House File 483 and House File 484. Passage would prevent local government units from denying consumer choice when the people affected must decide the most appropriate fuel for energy security for themselves, their families, and their property. According to the Energy Information Administration report for Minnesota, from 2021 to 2022, electrical outage durations increased by 127%, and the length of those outages increased by 96%. And this is without the influx of data centers that has been kind of a hot topic in the news lately. With that, a couple of interesting facts I would like to point out. According to an article in the Minnesota Star Tribune on February 28, 2025, there's at least 11 potential data centers developing in the metro area. Combined, these will require approximately 3,800 megawatts of electricity to power them, which is roughly the energy uses of 3,800,000 households. House File 369 was also introduced this session, delaying the requirement for some electric utilities, to meet the carbon-free standard. What is this telling us? Can we produce enough electricity, or at least clean electricity, to meet the demand? Are some of the electric utilities not able to meet the 2040 carbon law? Energy choice is what's at stake here. Energy choice means reliable and consistent energy supply. Propane offers reliability by being independent of external factors. Minnesota residents still need energy to power and protect their families and homes and businesses when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. Much is said about the transition to clean energy. The reality is that propane is considerably cleaner and less expensive than electricity in Minnesota today, including wind and solar. Electrification decisions are being made on emission reductions that a utility expects to achieve, yet there is no mention of the utility reductions that propane expects to achieve. The U.S. produces considerable amounts of renewable propane.
Just a moment. This is government operations. I've served several terms on the Energy Committee.
Okay.
But your testimony seems to be aimed at the other committee. Do you have anything about the impact of regulations, the difficulties of, hooking up and et cetera? And then the next committee will be housing, which will, maybe have a little bit more of a different type of discussion.
All right. Well, I'll move on to I'll just close out then, kind of tag on to what Representative Mecklen said earlier. Currently, there are 153 million Americans, 46% of the population, that live in 26 energy choice states, including many states that are going quickly and attracting new residents. So energy choice and freedom will provide essential life-saving energy options for consumers. With that, thank you, Chair Quam, and thank you, Representative Mecklen, for carrying this bill.
Thank you.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this conversation, the energy conversation, to the Elections and Local Government Committee today. It's kind of fun to talk energy issues here. Question for the author or either of the testifiers. Are there any cities in Minnesota that have tried to implement a eliminating new gas hookups?
To the author? Representative Akam, I'm surprised by the question, as it's come up in the Energy Committee numerous times, that there have been counties and cities that have brought this idea forward to prohibit the running of natural gas lines to new construction. But yes, in Hennepin County, I believe, has had resolutions. I don't believe they passed yet, but they have brought it forth.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I think that in California, some cities have passed bans on new gas hookups. And if I understand correctly, the Ninth Circuit invalidated those, the Ninth Circuit Court, and so they have found them not to be enforceable. And so wouldn't there need to be a change in federal law in order for cities or counties within Minnesota to implement such bans?
Representative Akam, unless you're in that same circuit, it only impacts that circuit. It would not be national unless it went up to the Supreme Court. So your question really doesn't have validity unless it became a Supreme Court and then or a federal law was passed, because oftentimes the determinations are restricted to that district on different issues. Because I know there's been multiple things of where one, you know, the same issue in one district, there was a judge ruled this way, in another district, a judge ruled exactly opposite. And so I don't want the author to have to, you know, wait till you get to the Judiciary Committee for such questions.
Oh, so it's going to go there. Is this going to Judiciary? I'm so glad to hear that.
This is going to housing because the main subject area and topic has to do with housing. And I'm not sure where the next one is. If there was a Judiciary thing coming up, if that committee asked, I'm sure they would. Did you have a follow-up question?
I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I bring up the Ninth Circuit only to recognize the precedent that's been set in that there aren't cities in or counties in Minnesota that have done this. I think that a couple of the comments that were made by the testifiers about affordability and also by the author informing us that his air source heat pump hasn't been working, which is unfortunate. Mine's been working really well, so I could get you a good name of an electrician who can maybe come help you out. But my air source heat pump on these really sunny days has been powered solely by my solar panels, and it's also powered my car. And so when we talk about affordability issues, that's the affordability issues that make our transition to clean energy possible. And so when we talk about our dependence on natural gas and propane, there are big concerns about volatility in markets. And this is maybe off topic to really my concerns about this bill, but with the tariffs coming from the federal government, potential tariffs, and so much of our natural gas and propane coming from Canada, we have some concerns to be looking at as we go forward. My concerns about this bill really lie in that the issues around utility hookups should be talked about at a local level where you have the closest connection with your elected leaders who can be responsive to communities' concerns or interests. And so I think as we talk about issues around banning something, whether it's plastic bags, whether it's gas hookups, I think that we need to be understanding and recognizing the importance of engaging with our local communities on that and allowing them the opportunity to have a voice in the outcomes that come that are provided by such bans or other encouragement of programs too. So I think that this is an unnecessary bill, and I think that it would be much better suited at the local level rather than at a statewide level. And so for those reasons, I would encourage my members or our members on this side to vote no.
Thank you, Representative Acum. And I like how you were able to both say you didn't need anything like this because it's federally, you know, determined by a ninth district court, and then to say, well, we really shouldn't be meddling with the cities. So you're covering all the way from federal to the local on the argument. So I'm glad you've covered that. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Micklin, I was questioning the need for this as well, but then, you know, over the last couple of years, we hear of our friends on the other side of the aisle wanting to ban gas stoves and the goal to go to 2040 with, total renewable energy, just not sustainable. If Minnesota is foolish enough to ban gas hookups, that would only increase the cost of the electricity and energy in homes and buildings going forward. Wouldn't you say so?
To the author.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, yes, in a short answer, but furthermore, if you were to do mandated, force people to switch over, many of these older homes wouldn't even have the drop and ample power supply coming off of their, on the feeder line to their home, so it would actually incur a much greater cost. Furthermore, in an area where I live, which the next bill will talk more about propane, but that's all I have is propane or electricity. In this case, when the heat pump fails, then I have nothing. So it is the importance. And if you look at when we have blackouts and brownouts, more so blackouts, 8 more people die from the cold than they do from the heat. So in our climate, I think it's a very prudent conversation, and I would hope that we can pass this bill off to the next committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just that it is important that we do this today because of the talk of future of banning natural gas and or natural gas hookups in future buildings. So unfortunately, because of some ideas that really aren't wise for our energy sake, we have to do some preemptive legislation. And for that purpose, I'm sure that myself and the rest of my colleagues on this side will be voting yes for your common sense bill.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a non-voting member of this committee, I forget, am I able to call for a roll call, or should I ask somebody else to do that?
Representative Freiberg, I will,
Mr. Chair,
ask for a roll call.
No, thank you.
Okay. All right. I'll ask you to ask for roll calls from now on, Mr. Chair. No, just to follow up on that, I mean, I think it's important. I think this is an important area where local control is important. We have a letter in our packets from the League of Minnesota Cities opposed to both this and the following bill. There are situations where, you know, maybe the state needs to step in on some issues related to local governance, but this isn't one of them. I'm glad we have Chair Akam on this committee. I don't have much else to say because she covered it so thoroughly. So thank you for requesting a roll call.
You're welcome, Representative Freitag. We've sat next to Freiberg. Again, I apologize.
I thought you were kidding. You could have.
No, no.
If you'd pretended like you just do that, just pretend in the future. And
no, it's somebody I worked with a lot next to for a long time. And as we have over the years, we've sat next to each other for many different terms on, I think, actually this very committee. Any sum up by the author?
No, Mr. Chair, because we're going to kind of duplicate this here in a minute. So it's pretty self-explanatory and very short bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Davis renews his motion that House File 484 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Housing Committee. And we're ready for the roll.
Chair Quam.
Yes.
Vice Chair Altendorf.
Aye.
Representative Akum.
No.
Representative Coulter.
No.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Gordon.
Yes.
Representative Greenman.
No.
Representative Lee.
No.
Representative McDonald.
Aye.
Representative Roach.
Aye.
Representative Vernig.
No.
There being 6 ayes and 5 nays, the bill passes and is being re-referred to the Housing Committee. And to the author on the next flavor.
Thank you, Mr.
Let me first, Representative Davis, you had a motion. Oh, no, Representative Gordon had the motion.
I'll take that one, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I'll move that move HF 483 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Housing Committee.
And author, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, much like quite a bit of discussion we just had, this simply includes propane and also grandfathers in. As I previously stated, we don't even have natural gas available on the road that I live on. I am the proud customer of the Propane Association people, or one of their affiliates anyway. And again, this is becoming a much bigger issue because our energy demand is going up exponentially. And I believe Representative Akam knows exactly what I'm talking about. There's going to be a significant amount of demand coming with the data center movement. And on top of that, the trend of people buying their EV cars, like Representative Akam's, it also factors into this, but to limit the means and the ability for ways for a person to heat their home is of great concern, and we have seen this in many communities throughout the nation where this has become a popular thing. And we actually, if you look back to 2012, 2014, somewhere in there, there was a significant push against that of outdoor wood burning furnaces. So I am simply bringing House File 483 forward to make sure that consumers have choice and we are not doing undue harm to restricting the authority or causing more harm to the very significant shortage of home building that we already have.
And to the testifier, please introduce yourself and testify.
Chair Quam and members, I'm Dave Wager, Executive Director of the Minnesota Propane Association. The testimony I have is basically the same one I was giving earlier. I can just add a couple of things. And the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator reported to the Minnesota House of Representatives Energy Finance and Policy Committee on February 17, 2025. That report stated that the risk, increase in risk and complexity is going to require significant transformational changes to our grid markets, operations, and technology. One example they stated was the potential for long-duration wind droughts. In January and February of 2020, there was a stretch of 40 hours with essentially zero wind. They stated that long-duration wind droughts could occur again. Also, that current storage solutions are helpful for short-term but not long-term wind droughts. Now, I remind you, and we mentioned it here already today, that these happened in January and February, and we just experienced two extremely cold January and February. Now, imagine going through those two coldest months of the year with only one source of energy. So that's what I have for you today. Thank you, Chair Quam and members.
Thank you. Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to take a sort of a similar tack, I think, to what Representative Akim did earlier. And I chose to bring it up on this bill because it is more specific to talking about hookups and how buildings are supplied with propane and natural gas. I'm not on the Energy Committee. I don't pretend to have a ton of expertise, but I do come from the world of local government. And when we're talking about utility hookups, we're talking about not a small amount of infrastructure, right? And I guess I'm wondering why, when we're talking about land use and infrastructure like that and utility maintenance, things that are all done at the local level, sort of sidestepping the debate on different forms of energy, I could think of any number of reasons why local governments may want to regulate infrastructure and hookups and that sort of thing. And one thing, for example, as I was thinking about it, there are outside of sort of usual ordinances and that sort of thing, there are temporary ordinances that cities and other local governments can pass for any number of reasons that we may not be able to think of here. And so I guess my question really is, when we think about it through that lens, when we think about ensuring that local governments can sort of, even maybe for a short time, effectively manage their zoning, their land use, their infrastructure, their utility hookups, and so on. I guess I'll just put it the way, I can't think of a better way to put it. Well, why is this a good idea? I mean, why should we not, why is it so critical, given what we've already heard, that we not allow local governments to sort of work in their lane in this way?
To the author.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we see that sometimes people may have their own political ideology or agenda. At the end of the day, this is about keeping people having choices, keeping affordability, and making sure their homes are staying warm on our coldest days. And actually, I'm not quite familiar that any local government maintains any of the infrastructure that would either be the gas companies, natural gas companies, or the propane companies. Actually, I maintain my own infrastructure called my own propane tank, unless I lease one of theirs, but I own mine. So I don't know where local government has to maintain any of that particular infrastructure. As a builder, I'm responsible to put that into the ground before I build the house. On the developing side. So I'm not familiar where local government has any maintenance costs or decisions to make on maintain local infrastructure, if that answers your question.
Representative Coulter?
I guess I we don't need to sort of go on with this. I wasn't necessarily referring to the sort of specific infrastructure. But you know, I mean, there's a reason why you gotta call before you build, right? And you know, we know that pipes and so on run under city streets and all manner of other things. That was more the point that I was making, is that cities engage with infrastructure, whether or not they, and I use cities because I was on the city council, but local governments engage with infrastructure in any number of ways, whether or not they're responsible for providing the direct maintenance. And so I think, to me, that is sort of the real concern here, is that, you know, we're all kind of for local government, for local control, until we're not. But I think in this particular instance, because we are talking about, like I said, often land use and certain other forms of infrastructure that local governments do maintain, that this, you know, I just don't see the need for it, and I'm not sure it's a good idea to take this route. So, thank you.
Did the author have a comment? Or?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say to that, since it wasn't really a question, but anytime you run a utility, I don't know if you've ever run a utility, but yes, we do have to dial before we dig to go for one call. However, there is a right-of-way set aside for the main thorough runs, and then we branch around the property depending on where we have to go. So that land use has already been set aside. So there you go.
Representative Acom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the continued conversation, and I'm really glad, Representative Mecklen, that you brought up data centers. And I think that we recognize the important industry that's coming forward and looking at Minnesota for their locations. And I think we're also hearing around the world that this is an industry that is changing quite rapidly, and a lot of innovation and technology is coming. And so while there are estimates certainly about the increase in demand and the increase in load, that's kind of uncertain. And so I think showing interest and having a completed project are, you know, two very different things. And so I think as the data center conversation continues, and I'm so glad that the Public Utility Commission ruled as they did on Friday, recognizing the importance of needing a certificate of need for backup generation, and just ensuring that we as a state who prides our access to water and clean water and the environment as a whole recognize the importance of robust environmental review on data centers. And so I appreciate you bringing that up, and I do appreciate your work on that. I appreciated that we went and toured the data centers together to be able to see firsthand what some of these things might look like. And as I also appreciate that Mr. Wagner brought up the MISO report that we had in committee. And you may also remember from that report that they deemed that Minnesota is the most reliable state within the MISO territory. And so while there is not room for improvement, certainly there is always room for improvement on reliability for sure, Minnesota is doing a pretty darn good job. I will say, you know, I think that Representative Coulter talked very well about the importance and need for having local control on issues like this. And I honestly feel like this is a solution looking for a problem. And so don't laugh at me. But I do. And so it fits. But I think that similar to the last bill, I would encourage that we vote no on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Since I noticed an excellent testifier that sat down in the audience, I did want to make sure that there weren't any persons in the audience that did want to testify. Seeing none, we'll go to Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think there was a lot of discussion about utility companies. So just curious if the author has consulted with utility companies about this bill.
Would the author wish to address that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have the head of the propane right next to me. So And also, this also ties back to affordable housing, and that's where a lot of this is coming from. And as we've seen over the last several years, the push for forced electrification, at the same time, we're also now in a point where, while Representative Akam pointed out that MISO did say that Minnesota is in the best condition within MISO, NERC also said MISO is in the worst shape of all the rest of the operating systems, thereby meaning that we're not, NERC did put that out there. So, that being said, the whole point of this is to make sure that we are not going to be forcing people to restrict what their choices are for their heating. And I've been a big advocate. In fact, we've had it in building code at times or locally for to be required dual fuel. So, because if you lose one, then you don't have the other.
I want to thank the author. I do miss the Energy Committee, but it is a little bit, some of those discussions are beyond directly with our scope. And Representative Lee, did you have an additional question?
Yeah, I would just say, there's one, entity here, but I think that we're missing the larger conversation with, all the other utilities. So that's why that question was important.
Well, thank you. Representative Freiberg. I got it right this time.
Yeah, thank you. Could you request a roll call, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to request a roll call vote.
Seeing that a roll call has been requested, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. Freitag out.
Seeing no additional questions. And seeing that some of the utility people didn't want to, I'll let the chief author have a final word, sum up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of thought I did there, but the fry tag out kind of had me after that. I didn't quite hear what the chair had said the first time, but nevertheless, this is something that I've been carrying for many years. I do believe it's of an importance that we make sure we allow residents to have their choice of how they choose to get their cover their energy needs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And please take the roll.
Chair Quam.
Aye.
Vice Chair Altendorf.
Aye.
Representative Akum.
No.
Representative Coulter.
No.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Gordon.
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
No.
Representative Lee?
No.
Representative McDonald?
Aye.
Representative Roach?
Aye.
Representative Vernig?
No.
Seeing there are 6 ayes and 5 nays, the bill has passed and will be moved on to the Housing Committee. And gavel's getting heavy, so I'm going to pass it on. And I will be going to testify to, 3 bills.
Okay, as Chair Quam gets settled in, I move that HF 1447 before the committee, and this is meant to be laid over. Chair Quam, if you want to speak of your bill and the DE1 amendment.
Thank you. And the basic premise behind this bill is to try to have some information. Oftentimes, I hear people saying that there's outside groups, outside entities that are getting involved. And so someone came and said, we'd like to have some transparency to see where this money's coming from. And so that was the intent of the bill. And I believe that I'm going to move, there it is. the DE1 amendment to get it, the bill, in the form that the author would prefer.
Thank you. All those in favor? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know this committee has a 24-hour rule. I see the timestamp on this of 5:22 p.m. yesterday. I mean, I understand it's a technical amendment, so I'm not going to raise a big stink, but I just thought I'd get it on the record, and at some point, if we want to do something similar on this side, you've been very accommodating so far, so hopefully we could be as well.
Chair Quorum.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. What happened is there were discussions some hours before this that something was discovered for technical correction and a cleanup, and so that's why we performed this DE, and it's been nice that this committee, at least so far, we worked together pretty good, and we understand that things happen. And I appreciate your agreeing to the reasonableness of getting it in the form at which the author would prefer.
All right. Representative Freiberg.
A related question, which I just thought of, since this is a DE amendment, I know our side had a few amendments to offer as well. Will those amendments be in order to the DE?
Matt Gehring, would you speak to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg, the amendments that are drafted for your caucus currently are not drafted to the DE1 amendment, so the page and line references are incorrect, but I've been in consultation with some of your members about how to update them with oral amendments to make them fit the bill.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Good. Okay, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up, Representative Freiberg. And so then with that, we'll all in favor of adopting the DE1 author's amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? All right, and then we'll move on. I think there's some amendments. Or Quam, sorry. Chair Quam, do you want to speak to the bill first?
Well, first I want to say, since this is being laid over for possible inclusion, a lot of the technical or nitty-gritty things can be worked out, especially if we discuss the intent of the amendments, so that, if something on the fly is not landing quite, technically correct, I don't have a problem with sitting down and trying working this out. Again, this was meant to provide for more transparency. Oftentimes, there may not be any issue out there, but if there's not transparency, people wonder. And you often get discussions and things that, call to question our process. And the more light we can shine on with maintaining reasonable privacy, I think helps to avoid misconceptions, misunderstandings, and arguments over things that really aren't there. I look forward to hearing and discussing the amendments.
Thank you, Chair Quam. And then we'll move forward with amendments. I believe Representative Lee, did you want to go first with yours?
Sure. I can move the A1. So I think because we've adopted the DE1, then I don't know if it makes sense to do a verbal amendment on this or to just note that the line reference on line 1.2 should not be line 21, should be line 10.
Let's go to Matt Gehring.
Madam Chair, that's correct. So the technical correction here is line 1.2. The page and line reference should be page 4, line 10, to match the DE1.
Great. So I know we adopted the DE, and we didn't quite go through how the DE is different from the bill, but this amendment simply would add an appropriation to the bill to make sure that the enforcing agency of this bill would get adequate funding for any staff work or any, you know, systems that the CFB might require. You know, like the author mentioned earlier, you know, this is a problem for, you know, both sides of the aisle. We want to make sure that voters and residents across Minnesota, you know, continue to believe in the integrity of the system. And so, you know, I think for us, this is a good start. I think we'd want to work on this in a bipartisan way, but also just want to make sure that the work that's done is actually funded. So that's what this amendment does.
Chair Quorum.
No, I understand the intent, and there's not a, I haven't seen any fiscal note coming back yet. When I look at the newest software that's been utilized for the treasurers where they're entering the information for all contributions, that it's going into a database, and at Motorola, when I manage metrology area, I also some database query generations. So having the database and the software set up the way it is, it would take very little time to be able to generate a query. I used to do that in probably about an hour or two for a much more complex set of databases. So I'm not sure it would need much additional outside work to do that, because I really enjoy the improvement they've done. I think it was just this year they rolled out that new software, so even an elected official could run it.
Thank you. And Representative Freiberg, you had a question?
Yeah, I see Mr. Sigurdsson in the audience here. I'm wondering if he could just come up to the table. I did reach out to him prior to this, just knowing this bill was coming up. I'm not sure if the DE changes anything for it, but at least the bill as originally introduced would require legislative candidates to report any, you know, right now we only have to report people who give more than $200 regardless of where they live. This would require them to report contributions in any amount if they are outside of the legislative district. You know, I have a treasurer for my campaign. Sometimes he enters the data. Sometimes I do it. So I'm fairly familiar with how it works. And there's not a space in there for putting in which, in the software, for putting in which legislative district a person lives in. And it can be pretty complicated. Like there's, you know, in my district, there's some mid-block legislative boundary differences and so forth. And I know Representative Greenman has an amendment coming up that I think is going to get at this issue as well. But, you know, I guess I'm just wondering, would there be a cost to the campaign finance board to do this? Perhaps Mr. Sigurdsson could speak to that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson, for joining us. And if you could state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jeff Sigurdsson with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I appreciate the question. It really depends on the expectation of the legislature. If the data entry screen could have as little as a modification where the treasurer, whoever is doing the data entry, would indicate whether the individual or association was located within the district, but if there was a concern that that wasn't sufficient, then there could be also a linking of this, of the application to, for example, the LCC has on the legislative page a place where you can put in your address and they'll tell you which district you reside in. To have a background check on all addresses to determine the amount of disclosure required on the report, frankly, the fiscal note I got on Friday, I would want to talk to my IT staff on that. I'm assuming it would not be real significant, but there would be a complication there if the expectation is that the CFRO application is deciding whether or not the person resides within the district.
Thank you. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. Yeah, I just think there'd be a less, a smaller likelihood of human error if it were able to cross-check with the GIS information that the House has, just because of, you know, not every treasurer is going to, or even candidate for that matter, is going to know where the district boundaries are in every instance. So, I mean, I understand the goal. I think it would be better if there were potentially an appropriation there to account for a cost, and I think it would be better if it were done in a way that there was some greater certainty on it. And I see Chair Quam has his hand.
Chair Quam.
Thank you. My treasurer passed away this past year.
Sorry to hear that.
And so I became familiar with the data entry software being utilized, and in fact, all contributions are entered into that system. So there wouldn't be, oh, we'd have to add additional. So the only query would be generating a script that went through the contributions and would have the activity of taking the information in the address cell and running a script to be able to verify what district that was in. You know, again, that's the type of thing that, you know, 20 years ago, I would have done in maybe an hour or two, because, and with the systems we've got now, it's pretty easy to generate. So I'm not anticipating there being a big issue, especially since we've got more than one site that's within our state government system for locating addresses versus, you know, the district.
Thank you. And Representative Lee? Representative Lee, if you want to close.
Yeah, so I'll just close. But before I do that, I guess I wanted to note that, I mean, this committee gave the CFB money to develop this new software. And so, you know, it's my understanding that when you modify these things, we have to pay more money to a contractor to modify it. And so I'm just curious if a fiscal note has been requested or, you know, if we can answer that question.
My understanding of the fiscal note has been requested. And my understanding is if you've got access to the database, you wouldn't have to touch the software that is entering the information into the database. You would be generating a query in that database for that. You'd have to also maybe have a script to be able to take, you know, extract the address, ping over here, and you'd get a it's equal to or not equal to. It's not a complex thing. So you wouldn't have to modify. I mean, you could do a modification so that you'd already have that done when it's – so there's another field in the database, but that wouldn't be required. At least that's how, you know, my background indicates the ease at which you could perform this activity.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, but if I'm reading the DE correctly, you know, we're asking for this new report, and so somebody at the CFB or a contractor would have to make this change, right? To show this new data on the reports that candidates file. Is that consistent with what the understanding of the bill is for the author?
Yeah, once you generate the script, and if you're going to generate a report, you would add that those few lines onto that report script, and boom, it'll pop out the report with that added on.
Okay. All right, thank you. Representative Lee, you still had another question?
Yes. So I'd like a roll call on this, and also just to point out, I don't think there is staff at the CFP to write the script, so we have to pay someone to do it, and that's why I'm requesting a roll call on this. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. With that, we will – there's a roll call that's been made. Okay. And then all of those – do we – okay, I'm sorry. Start. You can do the roll.
Chair Quam.
No.
Vice Chair Altendorf.
No.
Representative Acomb.
Yes.
Representative Coulter.
Aye.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Gordon.
No.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Aye.
Representative McDonald.
No.
Representative Roach. Representative Vernig.
Yes.
All right, there's six no's and five yeses. The amendment does not pass. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Chair Altendorf. And I just mentioned I have one of those amendments that sort of the we can accomplish what we intend with the A3, but there is a line item because we now have the DE. So if maybe I could have Matt Gearing explain how to accomplish this with the current bill in front of us, the DE.
Yep, and we'll hand it over to Gearing.
Madam Chair and members, so to accomplish the concepts that are reflected in the A3 amendment in the what is now the DE1 amendment, what I would suggest is an oral amendment on line 1.21 of the DE1 to delete the terms, or delete the phrase area to be represented by the candidate and insert state. So, so the effect of this change would be that the principal campaign committee that's reporting this additional information would only be required to do so if the individual does not reside in or the association is not located in the state.
All right, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. This is a simple amendment. I actually share the value of both transparency. I think when we think about, and if the concern, which I think was expressed, is out-of-state contributions, well, we're talking about is small-dollar contributions at this point, under $200. Anything over $200 already has to be disclosed. My concern with the language is just, and we've talked a lot about this, Minnesota has a proudly has a part-time legislature. We have campaigns that in other states people spend tens of thousands of dollars at Congress, I think probably hundreds of thousands of dollars on compliance, paying treasurers, all of that stuff. In Minnesota, it sounds like both our chair and our lead may do some of their own treasuring themselves. And so making sure that we have a system that works for folks. My neighbor is my treasurer. She's an accountant, but she's never done anything in politics before. So she knows how to keep track of the in and out, but may and doesn't spend a lot of time looking at the district lines. I'll say this is after redistricting. I have a few folks who are giving contributions of like $5 a month, and they were in my district until 2020. Two, and then would no longer be in the district because the lines moved, in this case, one block. And so I think not everyone is blessed to have the experience with both technology and systems that you do, Representative Quam. What this would do is say, and I think it would be administrable by our treasurers because it's very easy for a treasurer to look and say, this is a contribution from a $5, $10, $40 contribution from California or from Texas or wherever. It's much harder to be able to say, okay, I need to pull up a map where I can see block by block, does the district cut off here? Maybe advocates from your city or your county that may be divided are going to give you resources. Maybe just somebody who likes you, who saw you on a Planned Parenthood or an Action for Liberty. One of those two things, lots of other groups, but maybe they saw you at a presentation and they wanted to give you $5 or $10. A treasurer who is a volunteer, who's already taking the couple of hours a week to enter in information, it is a huge burden to have them look up individually. I think if we wanted to do this, we should do what Representative Lee, I think, was alluding to, which is we should make sure that there is a tool on the Campaign Finance Board website that does what you said, which is makes it easy for the treasurer, but that obviously would have a different cost. And so what this would do is say, if our concern is we want to make sure that campaigns are fueled by small donors in our communities and in our state, a state line is a much easier administrable line, and that's all my amendment does. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and we'll go to Chair Quam.
My understanding is that because of the deleting of for legislative and statewide candidates, there is some definition or confusion in with that change. I just heard about that today. I have no problem with trying to, you know, we're laying it over possible inclusion. I have no problem with trying to make sure we get the verbiage right and making sure that this is part of our discussion if the, you know, it gets included in a bill.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Geraldendorf. And I think this is the challenge with, if you look at the new language, it actually doesn't impact the legislative or statewide candidates because I think you're redrafting. The only change it makes is instead of saying that the, what we're looking at is whether or not you live in the district, what we're looking at is whether or not you are a contributor from outside the state. For our statewide candidates, frankly, that wouldn't matter because everybody in the state is in their district. But for legislative candidates like us who have part-time, frankly, volunteer treasurers, all this does is say, instead of saying we're going to have our treasurers look up where the lines are, what they can do is say, is this a contribution made outside the state? And if so, down to the cent, it should be recorded. And if it's a contribution made in the state, we would keep the current rules.
Okay. With that, this was a new oral amendment. And with that, all in favor of adopting that, say aye.
Aye.
And opposed?
No.
Nay. The amendment does not pass. Do we have one more amendment or? No.
Madam Chair, I believe that the amendment was made redundant by the DE.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Freiberg. Representative Freiberg.
That's fine. One thing I just thought of, but didn't really, I know the bill is being laid over, so maybe this is something you can think about as it moves forward, but this would expand the list of people whose names and addresses are getting disclosed. There's a lot of people who make contributions right now, some, frankly, who may make it, you know, in the amount of $199 just because they don't want their address disclosed. And, I mean, there could be reasons you want to disclose those, like if they work for a company with, you know, with business before your committee or something like that. But there are situations, though, where they might be part of the Safe at Home program. They might be have a restraining order. They might be concerned about stalking or something along those lines. And I think there may be situations where we want to preserve the option of people not disclosing their address. Have you thought about that issue, Chair Quam, or is that something you're interested in looking at as this moves, if this comes forward at a later stage after being laid over?
Chair Quam.
Secretary of State has part of the activities is to prevent the address of, you know, somebody who is needs to have it not public. That's already shielded through activities. My intent is to have it just so you know how much is coming from out of state, out of district, that type of thing. I'm fine with not having the names visible. And if we want to, in the final language, so the report, all it will come up with saying is, for this House district, contribution to this candidate, 80% were in district and 20% were out of district. I mean, I'm fine with that because, again, this came from people wondering if somebody was messing around because all this money flowed in there. And to me, if you feel it's good to have transparency, just knowing that this amount came from, and what we could do is also add adjoining districts. I'm in my third district. So if it's from people that you used to be, so anything that was adjoining you probably would include any past districts. We can do that kind of tweak because it's being laid over, and we can come up with a reasonable bill because that's what we're here to do as a committee.
All right.
So I understand your intent, and I will work on if this is possibly included to address in a reasonable fashion.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
All right. And with that, HF 1447 will be laid over as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you. Chair Quam, do you want to move your next bill?
Okay. I will move that HF 1496 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Registry. And basically, this came about because when we went with, permanent absentee ballot list, there was an occasion in the past election, at least one, that you may have heard about of where the child of a person that died was involved in trying to vote with that person's absentee vote. And it's pretty simple. We've got a system at the federal level, the Help America Vote Act, set up to where you can verify if a person died, if they've moved. In other words, verify that the registration is still good. And so that's what this bill is to do, is say, before we automatically send out a absentee ballot, that we go ahead and run it through a verification, make sure it's still good, and then we send it out. If it's not, then we have to look into that, as we should, anytime things are flagged as a bad registration. And if it could be fixed, then it can be sent out. But if it's, again, a deceased person or somebody that now lives in another state, then, we wouldn't be sending out the absentee ballot. So to me, it's a common sense thing to do. And I understand there might be somebody coming forward to...
There's a testifier here from the Secretary of State, Nicole Freeman. If you want to take a seat and say your name.
Thank you, Chair Altendorf and Chair Quam. Nicole Freeman, the Office of the Secretary of State. So today I just want to say we're here to talk on this bill, and we share in the goal of ensuring that only eligible voters are participating in our elections. It was helpful to hear sort of the impetus for the bill, Chair Quam, because I think part of our feedback is that those checks that you're talking about, they are happening, and those updates are happening on a regular basis. And so, as you all know, when a voter registers to vote, so before they even can apply for when they're registering to vote, which was about 95% of absentee ballots that were cast by registered voters, their record is verified through either the Social Security Administration or the Minnesota Drivers and Vehicle Services data. And so this verification confirms the identity of the individual. So it confirms their name, their ID number, and the date of birth that they're matching up to those two databases. Additionally, then, as you all know, when a voter is registered, a postal verification card gets mailed out. That verification, that PVC, as we call them, that shows that the person lives where they say they live. So they're required to be sent by non-forwardable mail. So if we get those back, records are challenged, and there's kind of a whole process with those cards afterwards. So I think the first piece of feedback is that the DVS and the Social Security Administration databases, they just confirm the person's identity. and that the records in the voter registration system, they're continually updated through many sources. I know when my colleague Paul Linnell was here, he ran through them, but we do get at least monthly, if not more frequent, updates from drivers and vehicle services transactions. So all of those transactions through DVS are compared with current registered voters. In addition to the automatic voter registration process. And so through that, we're able to capture address changes and name changes that way. Our national change of address list we use from USPS, so that does capture address changes as they're reported by individuals. We receive out-of-state reports from other states. Those are if a voter indicates on their new in their new state where they live, hey, I used to be registered in Minnesota, then we get that data. We're also a member of the Electronic Registration Information Center, also known as ERIC for short. It's a data sharing consortium among several states. And so through that process, we're able to compare Minnesota's voter records with other states' voter records. So if we see that someone has, you know, more recently registered in another state, we can remove them from our records to keep them clean. The situation that you mentioned, Chair Quam, relating to death records, we do get those on a monthly basis from the Social Security Administration as well as the Department of Health. I think what happened in that specific situation, if I'm remembering the details correctly, is the voter's ballot was mailed out. The voters, and right around that same time, the individual passed away. And then when that ballot was returned, it was realized right away, hey, something's going on here. This person, we got a deceased voter record there. So those death records do come through on a monthly basis, as do records from the court that covers any name changes, as well as if someone's right to vote has been removed due to guardianship. And then finally, we receive reports from the Department of Corrections on folks who are incarcerated or released from incarceration. And so these processes keep our voter records up to date. And so I think we're happy to work with you to try to suss out how we can, you know, accomplish the goal of ensuring that these eligible voters are the ones receiving ballots. And I think more generally, as we get to the, or more specifically on the permanent absentee voter process, it was the first statewide elections where this process was implemented last year. And so I do think we're happy to work with the committee, with the Association of County Officers, you know, to keep working and refining the process to figure out how to make sure we're keeping those lists clean. So thanks.
Is there any discussion on the bill or any other testifiers? Nope. Representative Roach.
I just had a question, Madam Chair, real quick, with the Secretary of State's office. Appreciate you speaking today. Sir, did you guys come for or against this bill today? I guess I didn't get clarification on that.
Yeah, sure. I think that that we would not be in favor of the bill as it's written.
Representative Roach, did you have a follow-up? No. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. A question for the author on, I appreciated kind of talking through how this would work, but has there been a fiscal note requested for the bill?
Chair Quam.
Fiscal note.
Chair Quam.
I thought I heard two people talking. Can you restate the question so I can hear it?
Has there been a fiscal note requested for this bill?
Chair Quam.
That I am not, I'm not sure, because this is a function that the Secretary of State's office should be doing verification before sending out materials. If you remember, I believe we had a presentation about the audit on, you know, from 2018, 2019 timeframe. There were a couple of them, and that there were over 16,000 bad registrations that were not told to the auditors. So they had that second audit and looked through. During that time period, there was also a letter to the Secretary of State what activities were done to verify those over 16,000 bad registrations that were flagged by the federal system. And the Secretary of State's response was, it's the counties. So letters went out to 15 counties, the 10 largest, and additional ones to get geographic coverage. And the head of the County Auditors Association stated, well, we really can't do that because the database is fluid. And it just came down to it wasn't done. And we're talking, you know, at that time, the election was over 16,000. The next election was over 15,000. And then with the postcards that sent out, what I've been seeing for many, many years has been sampling of those postcards. So I haven't seen any confirmation that 100% of it's been done. So I think that there are some holes that have become visible. And then during the testimony that was given just minutes ago, I heard the words, if they indicate. So that again adds some little bit of gray, fuzzy, it might not be completely looked at. So, you know, frankly, if there's a system that's available, that's being used by all the states that have, participate in the federal elections to be able to do a verify, it's a fairly small list, I'm assuming, of this lifelong permanent absentee ballots being sent out to where you could run it through that system in a reasonable amount of time and have those assurances. So, you know, frankly, it's the job of the Secretary of State to ensure the reliability and the confidence in our election system. And this bill would actually help address that, to have people feel more comfortable, because these onesie twosie things of where there's stories about this or that they hear, they wonder what didn't get caught. And if we can say we've got this, so no absentee ballot is mailed out that hasn't been rechecked before we mail it, that it's still a good one. I mean, that will make people more confident, and we won't have the angst after elections. I want people to be assured of our system. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, did you? Okay. Well, I mean, I appreciate what you're saying, that it's the job of the Secretary of State to ensure confidence in the electoral system. Chair Quam, I mean, based on what we heard from Nicole Freeman, they're already doing that. They have sufficient processes in place to make sure that if for any reason anybody on the list should no longer be, they catch them. I mean, the permanent absentee list has been kind of a boon to rural voters, to elderly voters, to campaign and election volunteers. Among others, they can now participate in the voting process in a timeline that's better suited to their needs. And it reduces the administrative costs on counties who can simply mail a ballot to voters instead of mailing an absentee application, then a ballot each election. So, I mean, this just seems to kind of place an unnecessary administrative hurdle, since the Secretary of State is already catching instances where somebody shouldn't be voting. So, you know, I don't think our members should support this bill at this time.
Chair Quam? No. Okay. Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question about, since we're talking about list maintenance, and you mentioned, Eric, one, I'm wondering, just because some folks are new to the committee, but could you give a little sense of how that works, how the list maintenance processes you already do, and also how Eric fits into that, especially with, I would assume, and some of the stuff you were referring to, the most common things is people moving. So can you sort of give a detail of that, about how it currently works?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Greenman. So, yes, so our office, the state of Minnesota, I should say, is one of several member states in the Electronic Registration Information Center. We share anonymized data with Eric, who then compares that data, and so with other states. We also are able to get drivers and vehicle services updates through that agreement as well. And so that is sort of our best way to find out as how people are moving in and out, really out of the state of Minnesota in particular. I was mentioning that the out-of-state reports, they only, if a state is not a member of ERIC, the only way that we would get information from them is if an individual says, I used to be a registered voter in another state, and indicates, you know, where that was and a little bit more information about where they lived. And so with ERIC, what's nice is that, you know, if you're sort of as one of the 20 things you need to do when you move to a new state, right, or probably way more than that, you know, if you don't remember to fill out those optional lines and you're just filling out the required information to get registered in your new state ahead of an election, we're still able to get that information from those ERIC states and remove people. And then similarly, other states can remove folks as people are moving into Minnesota.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for folks who don't know the history of ERIC, it's helpful. It was a bipartisan set of folks who were trying to figure this problem out, Secretaries of State, about when you leave. Most people don't leave the state and say, one of the six things I need to do is tell my county auditor that I am leaving the state. We get death records and all of those things are much easier because they go, their death certificates filed, but when you move around, and I know some, a few states have, pulled out of ERIC because of, I'm going to say conspiracy theories, but because of their own, decisions. What is the impact of states pulling out of ERIC on list maintenance?
Did you have a question?
That was my question. What is the impact of list maintenance in Minnesota on states pulling out of ERIC?
To Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Greenman. Yeah, so I think that what it means is that there's a few neighbor states close to Minnesota who have pulled out, and I think it just means that we are getting less information, and there are other processes, right, that we have in place, whether it's national change of address, but that doesn't capture everybody. And we have our annual list maintenance, where if you haven't voted in Minnesota after 4 years, but ERIC really does help us get information much more quickly, right, and keep those lists up to date.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you. And just my last question, because I know we talked a bit about this in list maintenance in the last 2 years when we passed automatic voter registration, but one of the things we talked about was when folks go change their address on their driver's license, that then updates more quickly. So I'm wondering if you could just talk about, to Chair Quam's point, to the concern that particularly as people move, that we are making sure that the ballot follows them. Can you talk a little bit about how that change in law in 2023, or that was implemented in 2024, would impact this?
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Altendorf and Representative Greenman. Yeah, so I think there's two different ways that we use drivers and vehicle services data. We have the automatic voter registration process, where as someone is completing a transaction, if they've shown the required paperwork and meet the eligibility standards, they're passed to our office for registration. We can receive updates on already registered voters as drivers and vehicle Minnesotans are processing transactions there, so that's particularly helpful for name changes and moves, like you mentioned. And then as someone is registered, the verification process that we use on sort of the back end of registration with drivers and vehicle services data is really to confirm someone's ID number, whether it's the last four of their social or their driver's license number or Minnesota ID number. as well as their name and their date of birth. And so that verification piece is something that, you know, those items don't change. Maybe a name change, right? But the ID number and the date of birth are items that don't really change. So once that verification happens, we verify that individual's identity, and we have these other tools to capture address changes. But the two systems that are mentioned in the bill and sort of the way that they're the way that right now our data interacts with them is really just to confirm identity through this process. And so once their identity is confirmed, whether those two databases don't confirm to us that someone lives where they say they live, we have a different process for that. So I think we're really open to conversation about how we can improve, you know, processes, particularly, you know, things that were that are new to all of us administering elections. But the DVS system and the Social Security Administration, those verification points verify an individual's identity and not necessarily their residence. And so the identity is, again, maybe a name change might be processed through, but we should get those updates. But the identity is not being updated through those two means. So,
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Chair Altendorf. And I appreciate that. To me, as this, we have this conversation, it sort of seems like this is a solution in search of a problem. And I guess my last question is, permanent absentee balloting is not new for some parts of our state, right? We have all mail-in precincts that have been doing it for quite a while. I'm wondering, one, we didn't have this bill then. Does this bill apply to those all mail-in precincts? And if, well, that's, I guess, my question. If so, then is there examples of this, of having problems in those places in the past, and if not, why not?
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know if it's a question for me or for the bill author.
Sorry, that was a question about the bill itself, so I think it's a question for the bill author.
I'm sorry. Chair Quam.
Thank you. I believe when it talks about mailing out an absentee ballot, that somewhere we've got it defined, mail ballot for those all-mail districts is different than an absentee ballot. I hope that we've got that defined. So this was only meant to address absentee ballots being mailed out. Maybe the testifier can inform us, are we lacking a distinction between the mail districts and absentee ballots? If the chair would ask.
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Chair and Representative, Chair Altendorf and Chair Quam. Yes, this bill doesn't touch the provisions in statute that that oversee mail balloting jurisdictions that have chosen to go for all of their elections. I will say that all of the ballots are mailed to only registered voters in those, and so the checks on an individual's identity and their residential address at the time of registering or updating their registration, those do occur. But this bill doesn't touch mail voting for that procedure specifically. I'm trying to look on my phone to see where maybe I can phone a friend with Mr. Gearing I'm just looking to find the chapter in law that is specific to mail balloting.
I guess
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. And I guess as a follow-up to the why not question of if the problem we're trying to solve affects ballots that that you're worried about may not be reaching folks if they've moved or if something happens, why wouldn't we have this? I guess I don't understand the distinction why this wouldn't also cover those mail precincts. That's an author's choice, because I think that there was a policy choice made to cover just permanent absentee balloting and not the all-mail precincts.
Chair Quam.
First of all, absentee ballot list is across the state. The small areas, these are low population areas. I think it's, if it's in the metro area, I think it's less than 400 voters. When it's, you've got your entire area is mail out. So you, the local jurisdiction, I would assume would be looking at that. We could look at doing a bill together to try and improve the verification, et cetera, on that. The point of this, and if you say, well, it's in search of a problem, frankly, I'd like to prevent problems. And if you say that it doesn't exist, we already discussed earlier one example of where it did exist if somebody passed away. And, you know, frankly, I think they passed away before the absentee ballot was sent out, was part of the concern. I mean, that, I believe, in the court case stipulated that the person died before that absentee ballot was mailed. Well, if we had a system here in place, then that wouldn't happen. So frankly, what's wrong with trying to prevent problems and issues?
Representative Lee.
Thank you. I'd asked a question earlier, and then I wanted to follow up and just ask Ms. Freeman. You know, there seems to be an implication that the Secretary of State is not checking for people who've died, but we talked about using the Social Security system and ERIC. And so this is a question for Ms. Freeman. You know, that I'd like to know, like, doesn't our existing system already check for when people have passed away? And isn't that checking with the Social Security Administration?
Ms. Freeman. Thank you, Representative and Chair Eltendorf. So, yes, our system already, we receive monthly reports from the Department of Health as well as the Social Security Administration. Since they're monthly, right, there can be time delays on either side of things. It is a monthly report that we run that is then shared with counties for them to process through to see if there's any, to see what voters might be matched up to those reports.
Representative Lee, do you have a follow-up? Ms. Freeman, I have a question for you myself. So you're saying on the death records, once you have one, that the voter, the name is completely removed from the voter histories. Is that correct, Ms. Freeman?
Thank you, Chair Altendorf. So what happens when someone either moves out of the state or may have passed away, their record is moved to be inactive. I think you might be asking about if they would appear on a public voter list then. And the answer would be once they had passed away, they would not appear on that public voter list. If there's a, feel free to clarify if I'm not remembering your question correctly too.
All right. Thank you. It looks like that was all of our... Chair Quam, any closing comments? Okay. And with that, Chair Quam renews his motion to have HF 1496 recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All of those in favor, say aye. Aye. Those opposed? The bill passes. Chair Quam, if you want to move your next bill, HF 554.
I would move that HF 554 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Registry. And I have the first one is a completely technical amendment to get in the right form. I would move the A1 amendment, and that is to fix a technical drafting issue.
Okay. Is there any discussion on that? There's no discussion. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Okay, the A1 amendment has been adopted. And Chair Kwan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A2, with discussions with city and county people, I decided on this one, which would basically small towns with populations less than 10,000 or smaller counties with populations less than 40,000 would not come underneath. And that would, I'd like to have this in to make the bill in the form that the author would desire.
Okay, Chair Kwan. Discussion, Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not going to put a huge stink up about this, but I understand sort of the prerogative of authors getting the bills in the forms that they would prefer. I do have an issue with this amendment, and I want to point out why. And I didn't think about this in time to pull up county populations, but for example, this, you know, I think I understand the goal of the bill, and we can get to that too, which is access and information broadly. But when we put in sort of arbitrary population numbers, we introduce an element that the effect of which is to say that some people are entitled to access and information and some people are not. And so, for example, with this amendment, limiting it to cities with a population of 10,000 or more would mean that folks in Arden Hills, for example, are not entitled to the information that folks in Hermantown would be. And so I appreciate, you know, understanding that smaller cities just don't always have the same capacity and resources and so on. But I think in this particular instance, you know, what's good for one city is good for every city. And, you know, folks who want information from their local governments are not less deserving of that because they live in a smaller city or a smaller county. So with all due respect to the chair and the author of the bill, I am going to vote no on this amendment for that reason.
Chair Kwan.
I would say that if you wanted to say 5,000 and 10,000, if you had an oral type thing, I would be open to that. But we have cities of first, second, we've got all these different things. If a city is greater than, I believe, 5,000, then you're in a group and you get treated differently for funds for roads and et cetera. The idea was, if you're large enough, you already have enough actual employees to where you could handle this. And the bill isn't saying only, you know, everybody else is not supposed to not. No, it just says if you're this size, then you should have this. If you're smaller than that, we're not stopping you from doing it. In fact, there probably would be more pressure and maybe you know, the different associations would have, you know, some assistant tools to make it happen. But the biggest push against was if you're small, you can't do it.
A follow-up, Representative Coulter?
Yeah, just quick. And I'm like I said, to me, it's more of an arbitrary number issue than the size issue. I'm just not fond of picking arbitrary numbers and, you know, city staff and capacity, for example. And again, I always go back to, I shouldn't just stick with cities, but I am still used to thinking like a city council member. But city staff is not, you know, you don't base how many people you hire on the population, right? So I like I said, I do appreciate where you're going with this. I don't need to belabor the point, but I don't think limiting like this is a good choice.
Representative Vernick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, and it sort of piggybacks off what Representative Coulter was saying. What if you have a city, my in-laws are from Pierce, Minnesota. Hillman is relatively close by. It's a population of about 24 people. What if your demarcation isn't the number of residents in the population of the city, but whether or not they have staff? So if you have a city that doesn't have staff, that doesn't have operating manuals, you wouldn't fall under this, but once you were large enough, then it would come into play.
Chair Kwan.
I do not think you would have a city with 10,000 people that did not have staff and wasn't basically required to do certain things by the state. So if you, it comes down to the fact, we can vote on this amendment, and if you bring up something different, I can do an author's amendment, like I offered here to do an oral, to adjust that. But to me, there has to be some sort of starting point. And so.
Okay. It seems like the discussion is done then. Okay. All those in favor of adopting the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? And the ayes have it. And then is there any other discussion on the bill itself with the amendments added? Oh, I'm sorry. I don't have any listed, but are there any testifiers here? My apologies. Please state your name and the organization you're with.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pierre Ouellette with the League of Minnesota Cities. You'll see a letter in your packet today with pretty much every local government group signed on in opposition. I'll briefly talk about why. We're grateful for the amendment, as it does, at least for cities, eliminate a large number of cities from the requirements, although there's still 100 cities within the state of Minnesota that would have to do this. This is a costly undertaking for cities to do. I mean, when cities are under pressure for property taxes, the rising cost of everything, keeping and retaining employees, there's a lot of pressure on cities to do many things, and also those things that they're doing are becoming more and more costly. I might ask the question what we're trying to accomplish with this bill. Cities work very hard to remain transparent and to have information they need on their website, automated services, instructional documents, trained staff, 311 systems, call centers. I think a lot of the bill's requirements are redundant of things that they already do, and I think we should leave it to the locals to decide what area their services that they need to provide the information that they give out. It's kind of self-selecting. Frankly, citizens just need to ask, and local governments can provide the information they need. You know, this might be a case where, you know, we have a disgruntled person who went to their community and asked for some help, didn't get the help they needed, and that happens sometimes, but also perhaps didn't get the answer they want to require cities to do a lot of work on behalf of it. So we think that this bill is unnecessary. We think cities work very hard to make their information available to their constituents and really strive very hard to make sure that they are communicating well with their constituents. Providing services is what cities do. They are operational. You think about how many times both cities and counties touch people's lives every day. There are hundreds and hundreds of operations that they do, and to produce this kind of document would be, we believe, unnecessary. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And Representative Freiberg?
Thank you. No other testifiers, I assume, or?
I'm sorry. Not that.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. So just a couple questions. So first of all, aren't most of the documents that this bill would make public available under the Data Practices and Administrative Procedures Acts?
Chair Quam.
Well, you know, for clarification, over 20 years ago when I was on the school board, any citizen came in and asked about a policy, procedure, et cetera, in the school, we had a three-ring binder or several of them there that, here, that's where it is. Or you can go to our website. Any entity that's has a decent-sized staff should already have everything documented for reference. So if someone comes in and asks something or they have to do something, here's the documented actual procedure. So there shouldn't be any repetition of, oh, we got to generate this huge document. Any decently operating entity of a reasonable size would already have that, because that's what their people reference. And when they train new people, that's what they train them with and to. And so it comes down to, do people come in and ask? I don't have, now I've been here many terms, and I consistently have people emailing me or calling me because they can't find out what do they have to do for this, what's the procedure, or what's still sort of common is if in a larger entity, they come in and they say, they ask, and it doesn't seem quite right, so they call back and talk to someone else, and they get a different answer. Well, to me, that indicates that their staff must not have what they ought to have is a reference of these are policies, procedures that we run by. I think the vast majority of the cities that would be of these 100 cities probably already have it, but there might be some that don't, and it behooves them to have it. It's not just for the citizens. It's ensuring that their staff and their new hires are doing the right thing. So I was shocked when I started in the legislature and I kept getting these calls and queries because I was used to standard operating procedure for our school district and the several others that were in Zed. This was already covered. And a lot of those school districts aren't that huge. So it should be standard operating procedure. And our citizens deserve to be able to go in and find out what the policies and procedures are. There is protection for law enforcement that we don't let bad actors see our game book, our you know, how we do stuff.
Chair Quam, we have two more people on, not to interrupt, but we have two more people, and we have about 4 minutes left. So Representative Coulter. Oh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of hopefully quick questions. But the language fee or assessments, I'm wondering, does that does that refer to like the overall rate, or would that refer to, you know, I think of, again, back from my city council days, you know, each property is charged sometimes for a special assessment for road maintenance and so on. That could be different depending on property frontage and all of that. So would folks, I mean, if this bill were to become law, would folks be able to access individual property information about special assessments, for example?
Chair Quam?
If you've got a calculation for the special property assessments, then it's written there, and you'd be able to tell a person, this is how we calculate the assessment. If I want to put up something or do something, what would the fee be? And you'd be able to see, according to this, by square foot or whatever it's defined, however you used to uniformly calculate and enforce, that's what they would find out.
Representative Coulter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, that's not what the bill says. I understand that's what your interpretation is, but that's not what the bill says. The other thing, frankly, that's a little worrying to me is that it specifically calls out child support obligations. It doesn't say here. Is that the generic formula, or now suddenly is anybody going to be able to walk in off the street and find out exactly how much someone owns in child support?
Chair Quam.
None of these policies aren't written individually for that person. A policy is standardized, and if there are interpretations or variabilities within that, you go by the policy to calculate that out. So if a city is randomly picking what they're going to have people do, that's wrong. But child support and those other things are very contentious, and we need to be able to have it clearly stated so that if they don't have a clear policy, it's only going to make angry people more angry. So, you know, you're going to calculate it. You ought to have something to be calculated by. And so if you can't share a general way that you calculate it out, and that's not per person, it's not individualized, then your city is not operating the way it ought to for the people.
Representative Coulter?
Very quickly, I don't. I will just again say that that's not how I read the bill. So I think that's a really big potential concern to me. The last thing I will just say is that, you know, we have heard from cities and counties and school districts that they are just drowning in Data Practices Act requests as it is. And, you know, we can and should, I think, have a conversation about how to address that. But I see this really as only sort of creating more what may be unnecessary paperwork for staff that are already overburdened. And I just don't really see what problem this is really solving for. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Vernon.
Yes, thank you very much. I too was a school board member, so MSBA has a beautiful bank of model policies that are available. Do you know, and I really don't know this question, do you know if cities and counties have access to something similar to that?
Chair Quam.
When I've talked to different cities and counties, their organizations tend to have some materials that assist them and set up their own policies, and what they do is they customize it for themselves.
Okay, thank you. I have
Representative Vernon.
Thank you. It says former OSHA investigator here, right? I'm a big fan of policies and procedures and operating manuals and safety policies. So it says to maintain those policies. And the question I have for you is, can you define what maintain is?
Chair Quam.
I just got message that I have to change this so it goes to judiciary. So I was distracted on that. Can you repeat the exact sentence?
Representative Vernon.
Yeah. Could you define what maintain is? Maybe, for example, does that include reviewing and updating annually? Or I've seen a lot of really outdated policies and procedures, some that were before I was born and I'm no spring chicken. So, you know, could you define to me what you see as maintain?
Chair Quam.
If you update and change something as a governmental body, then you update the statutes, you update your policies, your procedures. I thought that was how to operate. So that if you don't change the documentation and policies that you're doing to include what you just changed, that's incompetence.
Representative Vernig, we need to finish up.
Just thank you.
A final comment, or you're done. Oh, sorry. And Representative Freiberg, were you done, or you had a final comment? Okay.
I believe
we do need to shut this down. So
yes, because Rep. Freiberg cannot make the motion, I'd like to request a roll call vote on the amended motion to re-refer this to judiciary.
Okay. Thank you. So with that, we'll take the roll call.
Well, I would like to renew my motion that House File 554, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee.
All right. And we'll take the roll call.
Chair Quam?
Aye.
Vice Chair Altendorf?
Aye.
Representative Acum?
No.
Representative Coulter?
No.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Gordon?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
No.
Representative Lee?
No.
Representative McDonald? Representative Roach? Representative Vernig?
No.
And that was 6 ayes and 5 nays. The bill will be referred now to the Judiciary Committee. And with that, members, we are adjourned.